Hello there, and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School podcast. Our longest ever hiatus has ended.
Betcha thought we quit.
Some people did. Some people who have discovered our online presence due to, some events and circumstances and productions. They've said, "Hey, are you still doing this podcast?" And
maybe.
Surprise.
You'll get what you get.
Technically, we are still doing it. We have been going this entire time on our Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
Since we last posted an episode on this feed, we've posted a mumble, pretend I said the correct number, but I don't know, between 10 and or so.
We posted some.
Yeah, we post like monthly-ish episodes on our Patreon feed on, you know, like terrible Christian movies and terrible Christian music and terrible Christian politics and actually some good things at times, but mostly stuff that's funny. And also, I published a novel in the interim, which, to be quite honest, is part of the reason that this particular show has been delayed. It is extremely relevant to anyone who listens to this show. If you listen to this podcast as a way to deconstruct and correct your own religion that was shoved into your head as a small person, it is unbelievably related to you. But if you didn't, and you still listen to this show anyway, then I could list about 1,000 ways that it is also relevant for you. So anyway, I'm not going to spend this entire time plugging my book. It's pretty much all I do elsewhere online. I'll say a lot of people have said it's very good, no matter their upbringing or background. And I would very much appreciate it if you would check it out. We, in the interim, have done a pre-order fundraiser that managed to raise $56,000 for the Trevor Project and a charity benefiting the lives of LGBTQ youth. That was largely thanks to people, many of whom included our Patreon supporters, who went above and beyond, paying far more for hardcover copies than anyone in their right mind would have, simply because they knew that money would be going toward the Trevor Project. So thank them, and thank you, and thank everyone who participated in that project. So anyway, here's the VBS episode.
Hi.
Hey. That was Emily Kirk, yeah. Co-host of the VBS podcast.
I didn't write a book.
Yet.
I've just been waiting and waiting to do another episode.
Sitting right there this entire time.
Yep. Going gray in the meantime.
So, when last we spoke, we talked about King David. If the VBS podcast were all we ever talked about in life, then that would have meant we spent last year talking about nothing but King David, which isn't quite accurate, but as far as this podcast goes, it's true.
I've really been contemplating hard.
We have reached the end of King David's story, which is, it feels like a good thing to be, I think we're ready to be rid of this guy.
Mm-hmm. He's done enough.
To say the least. So when last we saw David, he's the king. He's powerful in his little corner of the world, constantly doing war and stuff and constantly conquesting both lands and the bodies of people. David, from that point on, from the Bathsheba episode on, he's not the same guy, which, considering what David, when he is who he is, considering how that goes for everyone around him, it's probably for the best that he's not the same guy. It's probably for the best that he's diminished and just kind of rotting on the throne. Meanwhile, everything's going to hell all around him. From here on out, David, his story sort of continues in the Book of Psalms, where lots of the Psalms are attributed to David, and lots of them are about guilt and remorse and hope for restoration and all sorts of things that David is probably wallowing in if he is truly feeling the pangs of the things he's done to people throughout the Book of Samuel. The Book of Chronicles also has a different version of King David, retells many of the same episodes, but with a little bit less nuance than the Book of Samuel musters. So it's David's downfall. We've seen David, the symbol of resistance, in our Goliath episode, when we also saw how resistance narratives can be twisted in favor of the oppressor. We've seen David, the outlaw, in our Jonathan episode, when we talked about how so much of the Bible can be interpreted with the bias of love. We've seen David, the oppressor, in our Bathsheba episode, when we wondered, what the hell is it about this guy that's supposed to reflect the teachings of Jesus and the commandments? Now, heading into the story of Solomon, we see a David who ends up the exact same way as every other king, whether they were a small-time warlord like the possibly historical David, or the founder of an eternal monarchy like the David some people see in the biblical character. David ends up dead, and before that, so weak and helpless that people are propping up his body by piling young women around him, which sounds like the kind of prescription a horn dog like David would recommend for himself. They're like, the only way to keep the king warm at night is to pad his body with concubines. Like, sure, that David made that up.
That sounds nice.
What the job of being the king's blanket? That's someone's entire job. Meanwhile, his family is an absolute shit show, the continuance of Samuel's theme of each selfish generation poisoning the next. We ended our last episode by talking about how the sins of High Priest Eli infected Prophet Samuel, and then King Saul, and then King David, and now we see the nightmare that is David's offspring with his billions of wives. There is endless Game of Thrones drama that we're skipping past here to get to Solomon, but the main episode to spotlight is very important. Tamar, sometimes pronounced Tamar, the only one of David's daughters to be named by the Bible's authors, is raped by Amnon, one of David's 19 named sons. Amnon was David's heir to the throne until Tamar's brother Absalom avenged his sister by having Amnon killed. Amnon's crime against Tamar is by far the Bible's most graphic, explicit, and unmistakable account of sexual assault. So remember what the prophet Nathan said in our last episode, telling King David that his crimes against men and women will lead to further suffering by women. Was Nathan telling David, because you're a rapist and because the young men in this country look up to you, including your sons who are supposed to follow in your footsteps, the example you're setting will have tragic consequences? At very least, we can read Amnon's sex crime as an escalation of David's crime against Bathsheba, whether or not we agree the text implies David raped Bathsheba. Either way, the violence is escalated because, again, in Samuel, violence constantly escalates as one generation's bad ideas become the next generation's worse ideas. Amid all this, as we noted last time around, Bathsheba's surviving son, who the Bible takes pains to tell us was not conceived during the scandalous episode between David and Bathsheba, but later, that kid ascends to the throne. As David is dying, Bathsheba and Nathan seize power and place Solomon in charge. So, Emily, as a former Sunday schooler and a person who exists in American pop culture, what are the things you know about Solomon?
Well, not a whole lot other than to get two women to stop fighting over a baby, he offered to cut it in half to teach them a lesson, basically. But so he's considered the wise old owl of the Bible because he had great thoughts about how to prove which person loved the baby more.
Pretty much. That's pretty much the if you ask anyone on the street to tell you a thing about Solomon, they will say exactly that.
Thank you.
That's a good, thank you for
basic.
No. You are the voice of the people. So the wisdom thing. Does the Bible actually want us to believe that Solomon was very wise, or is it propaganda the authors wanted us to see through, like when they kept telling us David is very good while showing us David is very bad? We are going to bring on a guest, and we will get into that. A lot of people think of Solomon as the author of the book of Proverbs. We will get to that as well with our guest. Solomon is said to be incredibly wealthy, the richest guy in the world with 1,000 wives. If that's true, then why do we keep saying biblical marriage is one man and one woman? Secondly, we'll get to whether he was actually a mighty emperor of a gigantic portion of land. And everybody knows the baby story. Which it's actually a widespread ancient legend about a variety of guys. Scholars have found versions of it from Greece to India. And that makes this like the sixth straight episode about the Book of Samuel having lots of interplay with ancient Greek stuff. And it's quite possible Samuel influenced the Greeks, or they were both pulling from some whole other thing we don't know about. Regardless, the baby story is not at all a unique story about Solomon, and the fact that it's the only thing Solomon says is in the entire Bible makes it hard for me to believe the story originated with him, which further lends to the idea that his wisdom is
a farce.
Yeah, and kind of intentionally sarcastically.
Man can't even speak.
Exactly. See, as always, we have a situation where I read a bunch of books and interviewed a scholar, and you haven't even looked at the wiki page, and you've still deduced exactly what's going on here. You have a natural intuition for all of this.
That's why I didn't need to finish college.
Like, we could just do this show where you just summarize everything in like 8 seconds.
It's a great Bible.
We'll start a TikTok version. And
we'll do dances while talking about the Bible.
Just wave our arms, say 3 words, that's it. Yeah. And even the baby thing, though, does have a meaning. And when the Bible authors pull a story from somewhere else, they twist it, they turn it, they find new ways to use it. And the new ways that they're using are saying things. And we'll get into that with our guest as well. This is going to be quite a wide-ranging talk, but, you know, the story of Solomon is, honestly, not a whole ton happens. It's, you know, it's not as exciting as the story of David. So we spun Solomon into a whole lot of other stuff, from Revelation to Genesis and so on and so forth. Also, you should listen to this whole thing. Typically, podcast listenership data shows that you have a guest on and more people listen, but it also shows that not as many people finish the episode, which that's kind of weird to me. That's not how I would expect it to go, but you should listen to the whole thing. And if you have any of our old episodes that you didn't finish because there was a guest on, you should listen because we brought the guests on because they're smarter than us, so...
I know you just love Jason's voice rambling all the time, but trust me, sometimes you need a break.
We are now excited to be joined by a guest who has been long anticipated by me in particular, Wes Howard Brook, a professor emeritus from Seattle University, the author of books including Unveiling Empire, Becoming Children of God, and Come Out My People. How are we doing today, Wes?
Doing great, Jason. Good to finally see you with a live face.
for anyone who doesn't know, which is basically everyone except me and Wes, about 3 years ago, I mentioned one of your books when we were discussing Genesis, and it turns out one of your students was also a listener who we ended up connecting via that. And I knew all along that I wanted to try and get you on here during the once we finally reached David and Solomon. I kind of expected that to take about a year, but it took about three. But hey, we made it. So thankfully that you've joined us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So Come Out My People in particular, I'll just cut to the chase on this one. It's one of my favorite readings of the Bible, one of my favorite sort of explanations of the question of like, what is the Bible about, right? When I read it, it just sort of, so many things just clicked into place for me. You know, this, like, there's this sense that when you grow up evangelical like I did, that the Bible is all about salvation, right? And, you know, a Jewish person might say it's about very different things, you know? And various Christians would disagree on exactly what we mean by salvation. But as you explain it in that book, the Bible is essentially an argument between two different religions, which aren't Judaism versus Christianity or monotheism versus polytheism or things of that nature. Could you explain for our listeners what creation versus empire means in your terms?
Sure. Let me back up 1 second, if I can, Jason, to just highlight a point you were just making. And I assume your listeners, many of them are similar to you, either have been evangelical or at least familiar with those kinds of things. The challenge is it's one verse in a letter that probably actually wasn't written by Paul, if that doesn't already scare some people away, in Timothy, that suggests something that no Jewish reader then or now would ever imagine, that all scripture is inspired, etc. In other words, to read the entire Bible like it was one consistent argument directly from the mouth of God. Now, any honest reader, if they don't start with that as a doctrinal presupposition, finds the obvious contradictions. And that leads some people, especially more secularized people, to throw out the Bible altogether. Well, why would we read this book full of contradictions? Well, contradictions is life. You know, every human being is a mix of contradictions, right? Every tradition is a mix of contradictions. You know, if we ask, what does it mean to be an American? Well, it depends on who we ask, doesn't it? And right now, what's more disputed than that in this country than the most foundational question of all, who are we? So it shouldn't be surprising that my view that the Bible is a set of texts from the ancient Israelites and Judahites where they argued amongst themselves about who they were, who God was, and what it meant to be God's people. That it's only would be surprising to people who started from that one verse in Timothy. Otherwise, it seems obvious. And as you were prefacing, the argument isn't between Jews and Christians. Christian is not even a category in the Bible at all, other than in three minor places in the New Testament. We can talk about that if you want, but it's not directly on the topic today. As you were suggesting, between these two different ways of seeing the world. And curiously, I'd like to suggest they're very parallel to the basic fault lines of how Americans see the world today. And I'm not saying this is liberal, conservative, or left, right. Those categories don't apply to the Bible for all kinds of reasons. But which is to say, did God make us to be us Israelites or us Americans to be one ethnic group that closes the boundaries on everybody else so that we can live in a pure way apart from everybody else? Or did God make us as an example so that all human beings could be joined together under the reign of the one creator God in our diversity? So Jews and Gentiles. So as you see, like in Paul, in Christ Jesus, there is no Jew or Greek. All are one. Well, that's that side. But you can also see other views that say, you like in the book of Ezra, anybody who's married to a foreigner can't be part of this community. Now you could say, well, see, that's the Old Testament and Paul is the New Testament. But it's not nearly as simple as that, because Genesis says all human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, not just the Israelites, but all human beings. So something had to have gone wrong between that moment of creation, you know, to say, wait a minute, we Israelites are better than everybody else. On what basis? Well, the only basis is the election. But you have to ask then, what's the purpose of election? Well, the purpose of election is to be a model, not to be superior, but to show people how it's done. And as I take it, the biblical story is not a rejection of Israel or Judaism. It's a rejection of a certain way of trying to get people to be a model. And it actually suggests a change on God's part. And the idea that God can change is anathema to some people's viewpoint. But honestly, any authentic reader of the Bible can't help but see God changes all the time. Not God's essence, but at least the plan. You know, God's essence is what it is. But what is God's relationship with humans is changed. One of the most obvious examples is the argument with Abraham over the fate of Sodom in Genesis 19. You know, and in the New Testament, for example, if we come in believing that Jesus embodies God, then look at the story of Mark's gospel where a Syrophoenician woman convinces Jesus to care for her child when he said, I was sent to the lost children of Israel. So there is this process of change and engagement, which is to say it's a love relationship. At least it's meant to be. And I don't know about you, Jason, but in my marriage, you know, it means I'm called to change and my wife, Sue, is called to change and our kids are called to change and they change us and we change them. And that's how life works, right? We influence each other. We shape each other. Sometimes we're better, sometimes we're worse. But a living relationship changes. And so Yahweh is a living God and Yahweh changes in this love encounter. But it doesn't. Yahweh doesn't change the basic direction, which as I see it is as interpreted through the lens of Jesus. And I want to highlight that. I'm coming at this as someone who's committed to Jesus as the definitive interpreter of Scripture and of God's intentions. And Jesus plainly sides on the side of inclusion and peacefulness rather than exclusion and war. The last video I was just doing in my series on Luke 9, where John comes to him and says, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. We tried to stop him. Why? Because he wasn't following us. It's hilarious. Funny, right? And Jesus says, whoever's not against you is for you. So he errs on the side of inclusion, not on the side of, if we're not sure who these people are, we better block them, close the doors, etc. It's all on the side of inclusion and gratitude and joy and love and gift, as opposed to exclusion and war and hate and all those things. And I don't know about you, but I certainly see the exact same fault lines every day in our own cultural context today.
Yeah, that's certainly a way that these very old writings, you know, will probably be relevant for a really really long time still to come, fortunately and or unfortunately. And the thing you say about, you know, God changing, which is a thing that, you know, in our, as we started studying our way through, was one of the very first things that jumped out at us. And that was very contrary to what we'd been taught as kids. We talked about process theology a few episodes ago. And there's this term that you use that also appears in that line of thinking, creation, as like a communal thing that didn't just happen once thousands and or billions of years ago, but is an ongoing thing, every moment creating the next moment, all of us together. And you present it as a, just to use, you know, very visual metaphors, like an empire is a thing that's contained within walls, a temple contained within walls, whereas creation is a thing that belongs to everyone, that happens on the mountaintops and the valleys. And that takes all of us. And it's just a thing that, that once you start seeing it within the Bible, you see it everywhere, from, you know, Moses fighting to liberate slaves. And then Jesus says a thousand years later, you know, the exact same thing. So yeah, it's been sort of one of my main guiding lights, as we've gone, just because it's the one thing that is undeniably ties together, you know, basically everything in the Bible.
Well, I really appreciate that it's helpful for you, Jason. I certainly know for myself, you know, I got to this project. I don't know if you want to talk about this much, but just for a moment, I did not intend to do this project. I was working on the book of Revelation in the late 90s because I was teaching in churches, Catholic and Protestant, around my book on the Gospel of John, which came out in 94. And in the late 90s, people started to ask me, what about the book of Revelation? You know, the year 2000 is coming and I'm nervous about that. And honestly, I didn't have an answer because I'd never studied the book of Revelation. So when I started to work on it with my co-author, Anthony Gwither from Australia, I discovered a tradition which had been in the circles I'd been a part of for decades, but I hadn't been exposed to yet, which is reading Revelation as an anti-imperial document, not just anti-Rome, but anti-empire in general. And Rome simply is the example of it at that time period. So it's not about the Roman Empire. It's about the struggle between the reign of God and the reign of its opposite, under the guise of human beings, but ruled over by the beasts and Satan and all that imagery from Revelation. So then I went back to Genesis, and I spent about 5 years reading Genesis in the Hebrew and recovering my childhood bar mitzvah Hebrew, which I hadn't remembered much from decades before, but working at it to hear Genesis on its own terms. And it led me to hear that Genesis and Revelation, oddly, despite their genre, wild genre differences in how they're written, are very similar messages. So that led me to, like, what's in between those two? You know, how do I connect that all up? And that's what led to this pattern. And that's what led to, as you were emailing me about, this fascinating connection between Pharaoh and Solomon, which is honestly my favorite part of the book. So I'm really glad we're going to talk about that, because when I was rereading it today, just to get it fresh in my own mind, I thought, yeah, this is, I think this is good stuff. I'm not saying that to praise my own writing, but just the connections there, I think, are helpful for readers who get confused about who these characters are and what their purposes are.
Yeah, let's get right to that one, because reading this portion of your book again, it just jumps out as like, could you give the readers the background on basically these connections between Solomon and Pharaoh?
So as you know, and I know, we both know, the risk here is oversimplifying or boring people out of their minds with, you know, scholarly detail. And if people want the detail, it's in the book. So I want to say whatever I'm saying here is plainly not, I'm not connecting all the dots. We don't have time to put all the dots out there. So if it feels superficial and pieces are missing, I'd suggest people might like to read the book. I'm not trying to sell copies. I only make a dollar a copy. So, but just to get the bigger argument.
It's a great book. So,
yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. So some interrelated questions is, when were books written? Which order the Bible's written? And you know, if you get past the naive presupposition they're written in the order we have them, then it's an incredibly complex question. And scholars have been arguing about it for two centuries, continue to argue about it. There aren't right or wrong answers. The books don't come with copyright, you know, and a set of data points can be argued different ways by different people. But one thing we know for sure, historically, Bible or otherwise, is that writing as a technology, and most people don't think of it that way, but writing as a technology, begins with empire. At some level, once you think about it, it's obvious. Empires need ways to legitimize themselves. They need to convince people that you should submit to our power, not only because it's good for you, that's a benevolent argument, or else, which is the other argument. And the benevolent argument usually comes with, almost always comes with, our God or our gods are on the side of the monarchy. So if you're violating it, you're not just having a difference of opinion with your neighbor. You're going against the order of creation. It's like trying to argue with gravity. You know, you can jump out the window, but gravity is going to win every time. You know, you can't argue with it. So from that perspective, the Solomon story is the biblical people's effort at doing what every other empire in the ancient world did, which is to legitimize its existence. Why should you pay taxes to this guy who's described as eating off gold plates? Think about that. Eating off gold plates. Why should you, farmer out in the countryside, feel happy about paying taxes to this situation? Well, what are you getting out of it? Well, you're getting one thing: national security. And that's the endless trade-off. That is the endless trade-off in all of history, is national security versus freedom. The challenge is, once you start to read this story, it's so suspicious of being propaganda at so many levels that it starts to come apart. But most ordinary Bible-reading people don't question it, because it's in the Bible, so you don't question it. And the text says that God gave Solomon wisdom. So if you argue with that, are you arguing with God? What does Jesus say about Solomon? In the Sermon on the Mount, for example, right? Consider the lilies of the field. Consider the flowers. The flowers don't worry if they don't store up in barns, etc. And then he says, consider Solomon in all his regalia is not as arrayed as beautifully as a flower. Mm-hmm. That is brilliant political satire on Jesus' part. So Jesus says all that political power and wealth does not manifest the glory of God. In fact, it may well manifest the opposite. And that's the Solomon's suggestion. Because how is Solomon described in 1 Kings? He's described as enslaving his own people. You know, it's right there in the text. This is not the hidden annals. You know, this is not, Dan Brown finding the secret story of Mary Magdalene, you know, and making millions off Da Vinci Code. This is in the text itself, that Solomon, you know, head of slave labor was, and gives his name. And it's exactly parallel to Pharaoh. In an audio thing like this, your listeners can't see the chart in the book that shows, you know, 9 different parallels in terms of words that are used precisely in those places and no other places, or in terms of the kind of characterization. But nobody thinks Pharaoh's a hero, right? Pharaoh's the quintessential bad guy in the Bible, especially since they're not named. So they become just the evil king. They're not actual people. The 3 pharaohs in Exodus are never named. So that's part of what's at issue here. Now, we can get into the details of the story if you want, but who made Solomon king? If you go back to 1 Samuel 8, when the question of having a monarchy starts, it says there are 2 criteria. Yahweh will choose, and the people will affirm. So that's what happens with Saul. Samuel, you know, is looking for, what am I supposed to do? And Yahweh points out Saul. Samuel's not very pleased about it. That's another story. But he grudgingly anoints Saul and then quickly pulls the rug out from under him. Again, that's part of another story. But plainly, that's the procedure. Yahweh picks and the people say yes. Do we see that in Solomon?
No, not it's at all. Courtroom shenanigans.
Backroom shenanigans. The text says plainly that Nathan and Bathsheba conspire to convince old senile David, who can't stay warm, so he's got to have this beautiful young Abishag in his bed with him, you know, to convince him, didn't you pick Solomon? Then how come Adonijah's out there partying that he's king now? You know, in other words, there's this battle for power among, you know, young politicians who think, I got an opening. But Yahweh's not in any of that.
The ones that really jumped out to me, I mean, beyond, like, Solomon's an enslaver, you know, and as kids, when we read that, we're taught, like, oh, well, that's how the world worked at the time, and he's very wise, so I guess that's okay, or it was at the time, or something. The other ones that jump out are the chariots, the reference to Solomon having a lot of chariots. As we know, Pharaoh had a lot of chariots, and he used them to try to kill Israelites. And we've been told in Joshua, Judges, and Samuel that the enemies of Israel have chariots. Like, it's sort of set up as, it's almost a nuclear bomb, the way it's described. It's like, it's this advanced technology that God's people don't have access to, and all of a sudden they do, right? Like, their military has this massive upgrade, and it's exactly the weapon of their enemies. It reminds me of David suddenly wielding Goliath's sword. Like, they're unlocking these military technologies that are exactly like their enemies. And the other one in your list that really jumps out is Solomon's quote unquote wisdom coming to him from a dream. Which, you know, again, we were taught that that's an authentic dream. That's literally God in his dream. As you point out, it's a dream. Is it a dream about God? Did God have anything to do with his dream? And we also learn, you know, back in Exodus that Pharaoh is a big dreams guy. And Pharaoh is a guy who relies on his own cleverness. And like, once you, especially once you, you know, point out that like Exodus is likely written at least in part, possibly in full after the story of Solomon, then it's the Pharaoh all along is this reference to Solomon. And it's sort of this bookend of like, this is where Israel came from. And they chose to go back. They chose to go back into Egypt without ever leaving Israel. And some of them literally went to Egypt, which, and at times it was actually safer than Israel. But it sort of makes me think of Shakespeare, like referencing a different king in order to satirize the current king.
Yeah,
right?
Very good. Yeah. You're a good reader, Jason. You should have a podcast on the Bible, you know?
I'll give it a shot.
No, I don't know if you just summarized it well. I don't know if you wanted me to elaborate on that, but you just did a great job with naming the situation there. You know, if you want to push it a little farther, so the Egyptian connections are, so as you were naming, I make the connection that's not in the text, that the book of Exodus, as we have it, was written as a counter story to justify the rebellion led by Jeroboam against Rehoboam in the next generation, which you see narrated in 1 Kings after the end of the Solomon story there. So Egypt in the text. So it tells us right away in 1 Kings 3, Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter into the palace. What? Just in passing, Pharaoh's daughter? That obviously means there's an alliance with Egypt. There's no other reason you would bring a foreign king's daughter into your palace than you've just announced an allegiance. So the first thing that he announces is an allegiance with Egypt. And then the text does something that scholar Brooke Halpern points out. I was not educated enough to know this detail, but he is, which is to say the long description of the details of the decorations of the temple, which most readers go, who cares? But he points out it's Egyptian iconography, that this is symbolism to say Egypt's presence is here, that an Egyptian here would feel comfortable, which is to say the Jerusalem monarchy is a colonial satellite of Egypt in that time period. And Solomon is their representative. Now, that, if we think of the Bible as, you know, the way we think of the Bible, we go, oh my God. But if we think of the world, we think, so what else is new? You know, what was Herod? Herod is plainly a puppet for Rome. Luke makes it clear that's the case. Christians don't worry about that. Doesn't bother them. You know, Marcos was plainly a puppet of the United States and the Philippines. I mean, on and on it goes, where people put in the people they want from the local people, or at least someone who can pass as the local people, to justify their rule from a distance. That's why the Egyptians, with great irony, given what we're talking about, called Alexander the Great a successor of the pharaohs and empowered him to be one of their kings. Obviously a Greek, a foreigner, not an Egyptian, but, you know, if he's going to rule and we're going to go along with that, then we have to legitimize that by saying, well, he's sort of one of us, right? It shouldn't be surprising to us if we recognize that the monarchical stories in the Bible are typical of monarchical stories everywhere. And the colonial aspects are also typical in that same way. Sometimes Jerusalem is a colony of other powers, most of its history, explicitly under Persia after the exile, explicitly under the Greeks, explicitly under the Romans. Why should it surprise us that a powerful empire like Egypt, seeing all this fertile land with farm, you know, products that you can trade with, even though Egypt had plenty of its own fertility, would not take advantage of that if they could? That's what empires do, you know, is they exploit the resources where they, and people where they can. So it shouldn't be surprising. And the text shows us exactly what's happening there. But it does it. And this is where Halpern has a beautiful insight from Stephen Higham's book on the King David Report. For those not familiar, Stephen Higham was an East German dissident journalist during the Cold War. And as a journalist, his ethical struggle was, how can I maintain my profession under communist rule without getting myself killed? And so he posits a fictional character who's in a similar situation in the time after Solomon. How can I, in the story, his wife has cancer and he's got to get this paycheck, you know, from the king. So he's commissioned to write the King David Report, how this, you know, basically gangster got to be the king of Israel and Judah. And he has to tell it in a way that isn't laughably BS, but is convincing But that the insiders can laugh at, that the folks in Guy go, God, he did a good job of really pulling the wool over their eyes, didn't he? And yet the people on the street would not know the difference. Just like we on the street, we don't know what the politicians say when we're not, when they're not on TV or the internet. You know, we only see the public face of them. And as you know, but your listeners might, I used to work in the U.S. Senate, so I know a thing about that experience. And so, you know, it presents it in this way. The insiders can know, we know that Solomon is a plant here. It's for our benefit, though, so it's fine with us. But meanwhile, the folks out in the street thinks that this is Yahweh's idea and that he's David's son. Like, what a, you know, and it's worked for 3,000 years.
Yeah. Like, I remember as a young Christian, essentially being taught that Solomon was this mighty emperor of, you know, I think the farthest I ever heard was like from Turkey to Egypt to well into Iraq. And like, there are maps where it's like, what in the world? He was nowhere near this powerful. But the Bible tells us he was, you know, very, very powerful. And it's sort of things click together if we realize he was probably just a vassal of Egypt, and we know Egypt had power in this part of the world at that time. So like, it's the only way to make it true that he was very powerful, even if his map was nowhere near as big as the one I was taught. The thing you bring up about the irony and the sort of like winking propaganda, when I was reading mainly through Samuel and the story of David, and how, you know, scholars, a lot of scholars sort of describe it as like just overt, shameless propaganda through and through. It just kept driving me crazy because it felt like they weren't doing the text justice. It felt so much smarter than that. Like, it felt like sarcastic, over the top, when it says like, this guy David is great and perfect, and then 8 people died and it benefited him, you know, and it says that over and over and over, like, and someone was assassinated and David had nothing to do with it. And it tells us 9,000 times that Saul died and David had nothing to do with it, you know, but it happened to make him the most powerful guy in the country. But like, it's this half-hearted irony. And, you know, reading Solomon, where it's telling us how great and mighty and wise he is, it sort of feels that same sarcastic quality to it. And the only actual evidence we have of his wisdom is the famous story, cutting the baby in half, which you have an explanation for that I don't think I'd seen.
But the trick's on the readers. But just so we're all on the same page, there's the two stories, that one that Nathan tells David about a rich man, a poor man, a traveler, and a ewe lamb. And plainly, any reader, doesn't take much to recognize, he's plainly trying to trap David into recognize his guilt about having Uriah killed so he got Bathsheba. It's obvious on the surface of it. But it works because Nathan convinces David that it's not a parable, that it's a true story, that he's not making up a little parable. And David falls right in the trap and goes, you know, the man who did that should be killed. And Nathan dramatically goes, you're the man. And David goes, oh, crap, you know, you caught me. As I point out in the book, Robert Polzin, the scholar Robert Polzin, really broke this open. That little parable is the master parable of the whole monarchy. And in the book, I show both Polzin's uses and some of my own, where it works at like 9 different levels. You can substitute different characters for the rich man, the poor man, the traveler, and the ewe lamb, and it works from Exodus to exile. But the point is, it's a fake story. You know, it's plainly not a real story. It's a parable. And then 2 chapters later in 2 Samuel 14, there's another one. Joab's frustrated with David because Absalom is fomenting rebellion and David's not noticing it after the rape of Tamar by Amnon. And so Joab trying to wake him up, and he hires this woman to tell David the story about a man who had 2 sons, which of course rises out of Cain and Abel's story. That's another thing. But plainly he falls into that trap too. And it's plainly about Absalom and Amnon. And then when he gets it, he goes, is the hand of Joab with you in this? Suddenly the woman disappears and Joab's right there. Like, he was just behind the screen the whole time. So readers have those 2 stories already, that when someone sells an elaborate story that seems completely out of context, it's probably a parable. Those 2 are obviously parables. They're both made up stories. They're not actual stories of characters in there. So what do we have in 1 Kings 3? Solomon is king, and the only public act in his entire reign, besides the inauguration of the temple, is negotiating a maternity suit between 2 street prostitutes. Really? I mean, really? You know, that's what we have a king for? Can you imagine? Can you imagine when a U.S. president on Inauguration Day went over in Anacostia across the river and found, you know, 2 street prostitutes? I mean, it's just, the whole thing is absurd.
This is the job we gave to Jerry Springer. Like, this is Judge Judy's job in our country.
Right. It's just absurd at every level. This is not what kings do. Kings lead into battle. Kings give you prestige on the international stage, and kings give you national security. in exchange for them getting to wear fancy clothes and eat off gold plates, etc. So the story jumps out at the beginning, go, wait a minute. And as you look at the story in detail, as I do in the book, it ought to be plainly seen that it's a parable about Israel and Judah, that the sons are the monarchy, which goes back to the very beginning of 1 Samuel, when Elkanah and Peninnah are there, and the man says to Hannah, am I not worth more to you than 10 sons? Right at the very beginning, there it is. And so when we get to 1 Kings 3, and there's a battle over sons and dead babies, it ought to be clear that sons represent monarchy. The dead son is the monarchy of Saul and Israel, and the live son is the monarchy of Judah. And the question is, are we going to survive under one monarchy? Solomon's wisdom is to be able to hold that together, a single monarchy. And that's shown by the fact that as soon as he's dead, the moment he's dead, and his one son, which is awfully suspicious in itself for a guy who allegedly has 1,000 women, one son? The one son is on the throne with no question of how he got there, right? There's no battle for succession, just Rehoboam's on the throne. And the moment he's on the throne, it says, all Israel came and said, your father was harsh on us.
Right.
The moment he's dead, your father's harsh on us. And if you lighten the load, we will serve you. And then I just love this scene because it's so blatantly sexually political in ways that people don't expect the Bible to be, but it's so realistic the way politicians and between us, men are in toxic masculinity context, right? So he consults the elders and they say, yeah, you should listen to the people. Wisdom is listening to the people enough to keep them in place. Then he goes to the young bucks he grew up with. And we know how the young bucks you grew up with are. They want to prove how macho they are and how tough they are. So they say, you tell the people this. My little one is thicker than my father's loins. I don't know who you're listening. Do we need to interpret that? Or is that obvious what that means?
This is, I think, each of our episodes has had a biblical reference to a part of a male body. So I think we've checked that box.
That's the example he uses. My little one is thicker than my father's loins. I will whip you with scorpions. Or he chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scorpions. And their immediate response is, we're out of here. To your tents, O Israel. See you later, Rehoboam. And he sends people after him and they kill him. And that's the end of that. And so that's the end of the divided monarchy. So in other words, Rehoboam does not have the wisdom of his father. Solomon gathered enough wisdom to learn how to hold it together without breaking people. That magic exploitative power of extracting just enough taxes that people think it's worth it to cooperate rather than to rebel. And I think in our current cultural situation, you know, you wonder how bad does it have to get before people say, screw it, we're taking to the streets. I don't mean the January 6th thing and the Trump specific. I just mean the general, you know, we've been suffering with jobs that go nowhere forever and it's not worth it anymore. Each culture and each leadership has to try to find that balance if you're going to exploit people, as so many cultures are shaped to do. And this one broke, but not under Solomon.
So the wisdom of Solomon was knowing exactly how far he could push people. I couldn't help but notice, like, the Samuel and Kings, this thing they do where they juxtapose praise and the facts, right? Like the lines, 480 years after the Israelites left Egyptian slavery and Solomon was enslaving Israelites are four sentences apart. We're supposed to notice that, right?
Yep, absolutely. Well, we're supposed to notice it all, you know, and part of the challenge, this is sort of the meta conversation of how to read the Bible, which I was doing a little bit of around the parable thing. But one of the challenges, and I hope I'm saying this with love for our evangelical siblings. I'm not one, but I know many, I've known many. I don't want to say that like a white person to a black person, but like I've been working in church circles for a long time. And obviously I know many evangelicals, and I know many I respect. But one of the challenges is in reading the Bible is reading it in its context, not in ours. And that means taking some work, but it's essential. You know, if we travel to a foreign country, one that's very different than our own, not like England, but like, say, Thailand, I think most of us would recognize we can't interpret their behavior to the way we behave. It's a different culture. And so you have to understand the local culture if you're going to make sense of things. Just for instance, in the Gospel of John at the Last Supper, it says, Jesus quotes a psalm saying, the one who is my friend lifted his heel against me. Well, lifting your heel against you is a first century equivalent of giving somebody the finger. But the point is, we know the phrase giving people the finger. We know the visual gesture of it, but we don't know giving somebody the bottom of your foot. But it's the same thing, but it's not the same thing, right? If I show you the bottom of my foot, you're probably not that offended. So we have to enter into the cultural context. My classic example that I gave to undergraduate students is, if you were from the future and you discovered the documents of this lost civilization called the United States of America, and you came upon this sentence, how would you interpret it? The White House sent a message to Wall Street today.
Yeah. We like, there's a way to read it as like a literal letter to a person who is Wall Street, you know, like you could misread it wildly, but we would know.
You think those ancient Americans believed in talking houses and talking streets, right? How primitive they were, right? But anybody inside the culture, anybody within our culture immediately knows what that's about. It's symbolic of the, you know, the presidency and the economic, you know, branch of the economy. And nobody's going to misinterpret it. Everybody knows exactly what it means. It's not ambiguous at all. But if we didn't know what it meant, we could guess a thousand speculations and write journal articles about it and argue about it in footnotes and all that kind of stuff. So you have to understand the cultural context. And that's the mistake that many evangelicals make, is they don't take the time to enter into the world of the authors of the Bible. And it's a joyous entry. It's work, sure, but it's work having a relationship, isn't it? With God or Jesus or your spouse or your kids or whoever. And but it's a good relationship has got payoffs, doesn't it? So, you know, engage in the work of finding out the lives of our ancestors that we claim are the ones who lead us in the direction we want to go in life. And the text just opens up in ways that you couldn't even imagine. It becomes better. I think some of the fear is that if you do that, it'll take away the authority, or it'll make it secular, or it'll stop believing in God. My faith in God is so much stronger now that I have a deeper understanding of who the God of the Bible really is, and according to Jesus, and who the God of the Bible is not. So according to Jesus, the God of the Bible is not the one who legitimizes empire. He's not the one who empowers you to destroy your enemies. He's the one who says, love your enemies and include them and welcome everybody. And life's meant to be this great big party. Makes me think of a Grateful Dead song, right? God thought he'd have a party, a great big party. He called it Planet Earth from One More Saturday Night. So if you had much Grateful Dead in your podcast here, Jason, but there it is.
That's our first.
It's a great line, right? God thought he'd have a big old party and he called it Planet Earth. You know, ask how many Christians, how many you expect that life on earth is meant to be enjoyable?
Yeah, but that's Genesis 1, that's Revelation 21. That's exactly like, right?
Isaiah, throughout, joy, abundance, pleasure. You know, what are the images of success in the Bible in Isaiah? The desert blooms with flowers, you know? That's the images. The dry places are full of water, abundance. You'll have plenty to eat, you'll have plenty to drink, you'll be physically safe, you'll get along with everybody. Is that not heaven? Is that not paradise? You know?
So like, as we've gone through Joshua and Judges, someone hearing this might think, well, how can we say that God doesn't condone, you know, attacking people, invading people, oppressing people, when those books show that? And your explanation of David and Bathsheba and Nathan's parable makes me think, well, was Nathan also condemning that? Because, you know, if in Joshua, Israel was the rich man and the Canaanites were the poor men, and their land was being taken the same way that Bathsheba was taken by David, you know, there are rebuttals within the Bible. Like,
a society defines when killing is okay and when it's not. But Jesus says, don't kill at all. Jesus takes it the next step. He's not starting a new religion. He's intensifying what he understood to be the meaning of the tradition, what in the parts that I call the religion of creation. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I highlight how Jesus consistently calls on the religion of creation text. He never calls on the religion of empire text. And his opponents are the upholders of the religion of empire parts of the Hebrew scripture. So the scribes and Pharisees, you know, are the ones who are siding with Rome against him and want to use Rome's power to destroy him. And of course, they do. Use that to get him crucified. He's the one that says, you know, to his disciples, we're not doing that. We're going to break the cycle. We're not going to respond to violence with violence. The only way to stop it is to absorb it rather than inflict it, to have it end with you. It's not that Jesus wanted to suffer. It's that he wanted to end the cycle of violence. And that's the insight of people like Walter Wink, a late theologian who did brilliant trilogy in his book on the powers that really brought that all out back in the 80s and 90s.
It feels like in the stories of Judges and Samuel and Kings and even Moses going from Exodus to Numbers, where we see over and over again this like cycle of liberating violence becoming oppressing violence. Like at some point it crosses some sort of threshold. And what's the Bible telling us like 2000 years later by, you know, showing this slippery slope of violence over and over and over?
So there's two elements here. Now we get to talk about the Godfather for a minute. I know.
Yeah, that. I was going to bring that up right after this. So go ahead.
I feel it coming. So there's a question of what any particular biblical text is condemning or praising. As I wrote, it's not clear right away. Is first the story in First Kings praising Solomon or trying to bury him? It as you were noting a couple of times, it goes both ways. So there's an element of that. But there's also an element of some texts are very explicitly opposing certain things or revealing certain things. So the pattern that I see of David that is parallel to the Godfather and also parallel to U.S. history. In the book, I have a footnote about it. I'd like to write a third volume on it, and I haven't, but I did teach a class at Seattle University called King David, the Godfather, and U.S. and the United States, one story told three ways. And the story is of people who are oppressed, who feel justified in opposing their oppressor with violence. Whether it's in the name of God or not isn't always clear. In the Godfather, young Vito is not going up against the Black Hand guy in the name of God. He's not claiming it's a holy act. He's doing it for survival. You know, the guy is extorting their neighbors and he's lost a job because of him. And he's a poor guy, you know, immigrant, and he's just trying to survive. But when he does that, people go, thank you. God, he was oppressing us. We're so grateful. And they say, can you do us a favor? Can you do more? And power starts to come to him. And as power starts to come to him, he does what people do. He wants to hold on to it. And he's developed structures to hold on to it and mechanisms to hold on to it, like assassinations and hierarchies and all that kind of business. And then his son inherits the power without having to build it up, without having to work on it. He just lands in his lap. And the only purpose is preserving power. Now, the original purpose of fighting injustice and establishing equity against an oppressor is long distant memory. And now you've got Michael Corleone. In the U.S. case, of course, it was King George, right? King George, who's the tyrant, at least in the words of Thomas Jefferson, who historians have argued that was a propaganda piece on his own part to justify the revolution. But be that as it may, King George is the bad guy. And yes, we're going to rebel against him. And then there's the Civil War. And as many historians have said, and this was news to me, Jason, I don't know about you, the United States as a verbal phrase was a plural until the Civil War. Then it became a singular, which is to say the United States are became the United States is. I think that's a profound thing that most of us don't necessarily know, that it was a collection of states that became a nation. And then that nation got powerful. Oh, because of all the agricultural abundance, et cetera, and became a trader. And then in the world we grew up in, I'm a little older than you, but we grew up in more or less the same, you know, world. The United States is a world power and is defending its power with any means necessary, starting with the Cold War. And the Oppenheimer movie is nice timing right now to highlight, you know, the cost of the bomb and what was going on in that. So the Bible is the same story here. David starts off as the underdog, although everybody reads the story like bad guy Goliath, bad, big, bad giant, you know, taunting the Israelites, and little David, yay, David, with his slingshot. Wasn't a slingshot. It was a sling. All the difference in the world. It's another story. So David gets to defeat Goliath. Everybody likes him, but he doesn't have power exactly. So what does the text say he does? He says he gathers all the outcasts and ruffians, and they go around town to town extorting people and killing the witnesses. Again, it's in the Bible. I'm not making this up. It's right there. They killed all the witnesses. They extort, you know, money. Nabal is the classic example, you know, a rich landowner, and he goes to threaten him, and Abigail, his wife, comes out and offers David a big pile of stuff. And what happens? The next verse, Nabal's dead and David's married Abigail. That's how it works. And so David works his way into it, almost gets killed a bunch of times, makes it to be king, and Solomon is born in the palace, like George Bush II, you know? And he inherits it. So like Michael Corleone, he's harsh. He doesn't have that balance. He's never been one of the people. He has no idea what it's like out there on the streets of Jerusalem. David has an idea. You know, he had to sleep rough. He had, you know, he'd been through all kinds of circumstances and he didn't forget. But Solomon has no experienced that. And so he manages to hold it together, but only with harshness, only with that kind of harshness. And it's all about wealth and power at that point. And you see, Solomon's not even a character. David is one of the, in terms of literary stuff, David is one of the roundest characters in all literature. Good guy, bad guy, lover, hate him. God, he's like everything. And that's probably the point, is that everybody threw all their ideas and put it all in David. Who knows what the real David is like? Solomon is like a cartoon character. You know, like he only speaks a couple of times. There's no roundness. You have no sense of emotion. David cries several times. He laments the loss of the very son who was, you know, would have had him killed. And Joab has to wake him up. Come on, David, get back to work. You're going to lose the troops if you keep crying over your, you know, the guy who was going to kill you. Solomon is none of that. And if you remember Michael Corleone from the Gothard, you see how he treats his wife at that point. The young Michael, he's a college grad. He's having fun in New York City. And now he's like, you know, no K, goodbye. Close, shut the door on you. You're not part of this. That's the pattern. And it requires a narrative that justifies why the people who initially engaged in violence because justice was on their side because of the underdogs can justify it when they're the tyrant and everybody else are the underdogs. And that takes some good propaganda to get that to work, you know, in any empire to maintain loyalty when you are now the big bad guy. It can be work on the national pride. Aren't we proud of how many territories we've conquered, you know? And that's why the United States, I think, you know, no matter what else happens, continues to expand our military budget, no matter what else happens economically, to a number that's incomprehensible. You know, is $700 billion enough for our national defense? Like, we can't even, our mind can't comprehend that. But it's a lot of money, and it puts us in that realm of people smarter than us must know what's going on here, so I'll just shut up.
Right.
Right? That's how propaganda works. It leads you to either feel like I'm incompetent to engage it, or yay, sounds good to me.
Sure. So we have like this David Vito America going from like killing Goliath, avenging Vito's father, you know, to being this, you know, being this warlord with a heart, right? Like David is loyal to at least one person, loves at least one person, Jonathan. And, you know, like...
No. Jonathan loves David. It never says David right, okay. loves anybody. Never says David loves anybody.
I'll choose to read love as mutual there, but yes.
Isn't that interesting though? Mishal loves him. Yahweh loves him. The Israel loves him. Judah loves him. It never says David loves anybody.
And
which just to add a footnote here, the Hebrew word ahav as love, you know, love is one of those words that can mean 10,000 things. The Hebrew word ahav basically means loyalty. Mm-hmm. It's not a romantic term. It's not even a marital term. It means committed to with loyalty. David's not loyal to anybody but himself. Other people are loyal to him. He's, you know, like so many politicians, I won't need to, you can come up with your own parallels. He's concerned with him mm-hmm. and his own future, and masking his national future.
And I guess if we decide the Psalms were actually written by him, whole other story, mm-hmm. but if we decide those were actually written by him, then we see like all these big feelings and big speeches and regret and, oh, I'm so overcome by all these, every emotion, which, you know, it sort of feels like Vito having a bit of a heart at times, despite being a warlord. And then, you know, Michael Solomon, as the, you call him a sphinx, which is perfect in many ways, especially if he's the Pharaoh. If we decide that Solomon actually wrote the Proverbs, well, there's not a ton of heart in the Proverbs. It's just like, be smart, get rich, like do right, obey rules. It's just like yeah. bleep, blorp, not a whole lot of emoting. It's you know, cold, like Michael.
And just to be clear, there's no way Solomon wrote the Proverbs.
Right.
He's attributed to writing Proverbs, Song of Songs, and Ecclesiastes, and they're all from much later, centuries later. And scholars know that that's unarguable, really, because the Hebrew is so different. That is one basis for arguing. Just think about Chaucer's English or Shakespeare's English. We can obviously tell, you don't have to be a philologist to know Shakespeare's English is not the same as what we speak. You might not be able to place it exactly in time, but you know it's different. Mm-hmm. And the Hebrew of those texts is very different than the Hebrew of Kings. It's even written differently, orthographically, yeah. as you know, scholars call it. You know, the print is different. The letters change their shape over the many centuries. So those books are, that's just plainly propaganda to say kings, you know, the best kind of king is the king who is good at everything, you know, acquiring, you know, exotic animals, which is where zoos come from, etc., as well as being a writer and creative and doing all those things. You know, it's your portrait of our king can do everything.
Yeah.
Aren't we proud?
Reading Proverbs.
David may well have written some Psalms. He certainly didn't write all of them. The Psalms are like a church hymn book. You know, some are old, some are are recent. They're written by all kinds of people. And that shouldn't surprise us. No matter what denomination church, I assume your hymn book is, you know, a variety of things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Reading Proverbs, it's like, okay, this isn't all that deep. And Solomon's not all that deep. So like, even knowing he didn't write them, it's like, I think it fits. I think it fits fine. Reading Ecclesiastes is like, no, this is way beyond him. This is far too nuanced and thoughtful. And reading Song of Songs, however, I'm like, okay, this could be based on some of his adventures, because this is clearly the one thing he was like actually passionate about, was collecting a harem. So
although you never see him being sexual, like you right, see David's lustful over Bathsheba.
It reminds me of David, how as far as we can tell, other than we're told he lusts for Bathsheba, as far as we can tell, he views women as like a way to be more powerful than men.
Taking
Abigail, taking Solomon's daughter.
What else is new, Jason? Let's go watch the Barbie movie now and we'll see the same thing. I didn't see it yet. My wife saw it yesterday. Why is the right against the Barbie movie? Because because what was Barbie? She wasn't a housewife. She wasn't married. Imagine that. You know, she could be whoever she wanted to be. She didn't conform to the roles.
Feels like Solomon takes that and escalates, takes it all the way, takes as far as he can, takes that lesson from, you know, from his predecessor, that like surrounding yourself with the bodies of captured women makes you more powerful than other men. And that's like the only thing he, you know, actually cares about, is maximizing that.
It was the nature of the world until very recently, you know, that women are pawns in the game, plainly. And owning women is a sign of power, whether you literally own them or own them symbolically, or, you know, they come to you or whatever. Ancient and universal across countless cultures, that, you know, having women is a sign of power.
Sure. One last question for you. I wanted to ask you something about Revelation, because your view of it as, you know, anti-imperialist, you know, uses imagery of Rome and it uses the name Babylon, but it's referring to all empire. Empire versus creation. I think it's a wonderful reading and it makes complete sense and it lines up with the rest of the Bible. I've also seen this view of scholars like Bart Ehrman, who read Revelation very differently, where it's they view John writing Revelation as sort of like pining for a Christian King Solomon, right? Like a violent, gilded Jesus, even though Jesus explicitly rejected that idea. So they sort of read it as if it's a story that is showing how people are already twisting the message of Jesus. And like, you both made excellent cases, and I think they both work, like, because either the Bible is explicitly rejecting empire, or, you know, it's showing that this person who wants a Christian King Solomon is at odds with Jesus. So like, I love both of your interpretations, because while they're very different, they end up with the same point.
Well, with all due respect to Bart Ehrman, I, not surprisingly, disagree strongly, and I think he's flat wrong on this. And let me just some things are ambiguous and there's multiple interpretations. I think he's just flat wrong here. And here are just a couple of points. The celebration is of a lamb. Not of the lion, of the lamb. The lamb is inherently a figure of vulnerable nonviolence. Lambs are not violent. So, and the lamb is repeated over and over and over again in Revelation. Victory of the lamb. And how does the lamb win? By shedding its own blood, not others' blood. What sword does it have? The sword of its mouth. Only words. The only weapon are words. There's no other sword. What is the victory? A city whose gates are open. A city whose God is tented on the street. Right out of Exodus. Right out of Exodus. A God who's tented on the street. In my last video, I put a picture of Washington, D.C. of a homeless encampment. God's living in the homeless encampment in the book of Revelation. And that's a tent on the city street, right? There you go. I could go on and on like that. It's showing that it's the beast taking this right from the paradigm of Daniel, which is what all apocalyptic literature has its root in. There are a series of beasts, and the alternative to the beast is one like a human being, right? Daniel sees in Daniel 7, and then I saw one like a human being, which is to say one who reflects the image and likeness of God, not a beast. Mm-hmm. So in Revelation, exactly like Daniel, empire is portrayed as beasts empowered by a dragon, who's AKA Satan, and And Jesus is a lamb who empowers people from the God of creation. The first celebration in Revelation 4 is the creation. Oh, you created everything and everything that's in it, and it's all good. And we celebrate God the Creator. A very Jewish perspective, I want to highlight, not a Christian perspective at all. There's nothing Christian in the book of Revelation. It's an utterly Jewish text from beginning to end, as evidence from the fact that it's a thin cover for Hebrew scripture, every verse. So we haven't mentioned my video program, Radical Bible, but just to note that for a second, I just finished, you know, my video commentary on Revelation, 82 videos, so people can see the whole thing there. And in that context, you can see both visual imagery, which we can't do in a podcast, or you can't get from the book, you know, in terms of artists and other things, but also the role of sound in Revelation as anti-imperial, to drown out the sound of the Roman liturgies that filled the streets in Laodicea and Smyrna and Pergamon and those places, and fill it with a choir of those who are singing that the Creator God reigns. So I think it's absolutely consistent with the Gospels. Jesus is only lamb in the Gospel of John, according to John the Baptist, and in Revelation, engages in a nonviolent alternative of offering himself instead. I saw a lamb who was slaughtered and yet lives, is the very defining factor. So I think there's honestly no evidence whatsoever to support that this is a reversion to the imperial thing, and everything to see the other view. And interestingly, the division is among feminists too, many of whom see, understandably, there's a male orientation, and women in Revelation other than New Jerusalem are not portrayed very positively. John was not a feminist. Nobody was a feminist in the first century. It's unfair to make that comparison. But so there are feminist scholars who have seen Revelation the way Ehrman has. But interestingly, the dean of all biblical feminism, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, has written two books on Revelation, and it was her work that helped to shape mine. She saw it as anti-empire 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. Mine's already 25 years old, and she was doing it before that. So one last thing. Something that Sue, my wife, is a spiritual director again, says, and it's so important, I want to highlight this. The book of Revelation can become utter nonsense unless you have some kind of experience that is revelatory that you can relate to. So in other words, some scholars will read Revelation as there's this like literary genre of vision, but he's really just a guy sitting in a room writing a story. I disagree completely. If he's not a guy who actually had a vision, then it's nonsense. Then there's no authority of it at all. Then it's just some guy's opinion, like the so-called church fathers who I decry in my book on how Christianity swamped the Bible, Empire Baptized. They were, you know, I just call them men with opinions until they became the church fathers. John of Patmos, he's not an apostle. He's nobody. He says, I'm just your brother, but I had this vision. That's his authority. I had a vision, and it came from an angel who got it from Jesus, who got it from God. And I'm just reporting it to you. And I believe it was a vision. Can you translate a vision into words? No, obviously not. Well, tell me about your dream last night. Well, it was sort of like, you know, how that goes. Unlike Solomon, who apparently can convey his dream perfectly. So is it conveyed through the language that John knows? Of course it is. That's the language he knows. Hebrew scripture and Roman imperial propaganda. He frames it in terms of the cultural context that he knows. But it's utter condemnation of everything that Rome stands for. Everything. It's exclusion. It's slavery, it's violence, it's exploitation of the earth and of people. I don't know how anybody can read Revelation 18 and not hear that. And hear the merchants and the ship owners and all lamenting the cargo. It's just, it's this beautifully revealed thing. It's like the veil has been lifted away. What were they about? Money. It was about money and power all along. And the moment that is gone, they go, crap, there went our markets. You know, so, I mean, your listener, everybody can decide what they want. When I do my videos, I say, I'm not here to say I'm right and you're wrong. I'm here to give you the evidence and you get to decide. You're right that there are multiple viewpoints, and Ehrman is among those who see John as having a revenge fantasy. Now it's our turn. And I disagree, and people can hopefully evaluate the evidence soundly from a faith perspective and decide for themselves.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. As long as let's all agree on this. It is Revelation is not actually about Kirk Cameron versus the European Union. And then we'll go from there.
Nor is it about China and the Soviet Union, as Hal Lindsey. See, the beauty of it is it's so true. It rings so true that it rings true in any time and place where there's empire. Mm-hmm. So people look out their window window and go, God, it looks like my world. Well, it's looked like their world from the time it's written. That's the brilliance of it. It looked like Rome. It looked like the Cold War. It looked in the medieval era like Imperial Europe under the Catholic Church. You know, it shows that pattern. And that's the brilliance of the Bible as a whole. Do we care about Abraham and Sarah and their struggles and, you know, to find a safe spot back then? Who cares? They're probably fictional characters anyway. But we care about is, what is the relationship between cities and the earth? What is the relationship between urban people and country people? Is there anything that's more at the heart of our American struggle from the very beginning, not just now, from the very beginning, than urban versus rural? Those city slickers think they're so smart. Those country bumpkins, right? We had stereotypes to each other from the very beginning, as all urban societies have always done, right? You always other the other as less than you. And the beautiful thing, I think, about the religion of creation, it says, we're all other. We're all one. We're not one because we become the same. We're one the way a forest is one, in its glorious diversity working together. Just like Paul says about the body, using a Stoic metaphor, but literally about our body, right? Our body's not a competition between our stomach and our brain for nutrients. It's a collaboration of these various parts that have semi-autonomous will, right? Now we discover your gut has a brain. I don't know if you followed that story, but there's neurons in your gut that are directing your digestion. It's not just up in our head. It's also in our guts. There's a conversation in our own bodies. But if our body's healthy, it recognizes it's a unity in diversity until it works together. Cancer is the opposite of that, right? Mm. Cancer is imperialism. Mm. Cancer is one part trying to take over. And it's necessarily deadly for the organism. You know, one of the things I like to say, and I haven't said it yet, so I'll say it once here, empires have a 100% failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
Unarguable, right? Mm-hmm. For all the eternal empires, they have a 100% failure rate. It's only the reign of God that will last. And that's why we should turn to it. That's why I think people should believe in Jesus, because the way of the reign of God is a lot more fun. It's a lot more joyful. It's a lot more beautiful than the grim, I got to get through this day and make sure I have enough money to retire and all that. God, that's a hideous way to live your life, isn't it? Rather than go, every day is a gift. It's all abundant. God reigns. All I have to do is believe that and it becomes so. The kingdom of God is right here, as Jesus said, right? You're not waiting for it. It's as soon as you recognize it, it's there. It's creation with all our stuff removed, right? It's just what is when we get our superstructure, using a Marxist term there, but still, out of the way.
That's great. From my tradition, I would be standing up and I would be saying, that's in the book. Amen. Keep it coming. These sort of things is what I would be shouting to you from the pews. So I want to thank you, Wes, for coming on. This was long awaited for a good reason, because this is all excellent. The book that we most discussed was Come Out My People. This is the one on this presenting this reading of the entire Bible. And I want to make sure we plug your video series by name again. What was the name of that?
Radical Bible. So if you just go to YouTube and search for Radical Bible, it'll come right up. Right now, I'm working on four playlists: Genesis, the books of Samuel, the Gospel of Luke, and the book of Acts, and Revelation, which I know is completed. And the idea is that they're verse by verse, but you can just jump in. And if you're concerned of a given passage or even a given word, you just jump in right there. It's not like a TV show where you got to watch from the beginning and go all the way through. Obviously, there is context and every story is written in a context. But if there's you just want to know about this passage, you can just go to that one and they're all numbered by the chapter and verse. So it's pretty easy to see. There's also a companion website at radicalbible.net, which has now over 600 PDF tables, charts, and various other tools that I use in the videos that are downloadable and they're not copyrighted. I don't even have my name on any of them. So you can feel free to use them, modify them for whatever you'd like.
Genesis, Samuel, Luke, Acts, and Revelation. There's a strong, those might be my four favorite parts of the Bible. So this is a great
nice.
All right. Thank you once again, and hope to speak with you again.
Thank you, Jason, and blessings on all of your work too.
Thank you again to our guest, Wes Howard Brook, one of my favorite Bible commentators. Always a fun guy to talk to. And yeah, this is the end of our episode. So thank you for listening to this one.
Hopefully we'll see you soon.
We'll try to do another one in 2024. No guarantees. But as always, we're still doing stuff on our Patreon. We're putting up a live event that we did in Madison, Wisconsin with former VBS guest Mason Menega, as well as Matt Brown, the internet's foremost video games college football journalist, who also grew up LDS and has a lot of fun things to say about religion. And we got him to say a whole lot of cuss words in this recording.
We didn't have to try very hard, so to be honest.
If you know my novel, the character Alexa, who just says so many cuss words, Matt did a reading as Alexa, and it's just wonderful audio. this show, our Patreon address is patreon.com/VBS podcast. We have a Twitter and Instagram, but like I Twitter barely exists at this point. But you know, whatever. And my Substack address is jasonkirk.fyi. Often I put up stuff there that is related to this program. Emily, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
You wrote a book.
Thanks.
Yep.
Do you like it or not?
Yeah, it's good. Okay. You should read it.
you're credited. It's both dedicated to you, mm-hmm. and you were first on the acknowledgements page. You. So really, I think this is your plugging.
Thank you.
You're plugging your book, yes. I think.
See what he had to say about me. Is it good? I don't know.